but she's my ship.
I'll accept your proposition, sir. I can direct operations better from here anyway. There's no communications left on the bridge.
Very well. I have your word, then.
The circuit went dead.
Rod turned back to the airlock. The Marines had won their skirmish, and Piper was waving to him. Rod went aboard.
Commander Cargill here, the intercom said. Skipper?
Yeah, Jack.
We're fighting our way to portside, Skipper. Sinclair's got his people ready to leave. Says he can't hold the engine rooms without reinforcements. And a runner tells me there are civilians trapped in the starboard petty officer's lounge. A Marine squad is there with them, but it's a tough fight.
We've been ordered to abandon ship and scuttle, number one.
Yes, sir.
We have to get those civilians out. Can you hold a route from Bulkhead 160 forward? Maybe I can get some help in to let the scientists get that far.
I think we can, sir. But, Captain, I can't get to the field generator room. How do we scuttle?
I'll take care of that, too. Get moving, number one.
Aye, aye, Skipper.
Scuttle. The word had an unreal sound. Rod breathed deeply. The suit air had a sharp, metallic taste. Or perhaps it wasn't the air at all. It was nearly an hour before one of Lennon's boats pulled alongside the cutter. They watched it approach in silence.
"Relay from MacArthur through Lennon, sir," the coxswain said. The screen lit. The face on the screen wore Rod Blaine's features, but it wasn't his face. Sally didn't recognize him. He looked older, and the eyes were dead. He stared at them, and they stared back. Finally, Sally said it.
"Rod, what's happening?"
Blaine looked her in the eyes, then looked away. His expression hadn't changed. He reminded Sally of something pickled in a bottle at the Imperial Museum.
"Mr. Renner," the image said.
"Send all personnel over the line to Lennon's boat. Clear the cutter. Now, all of you, you're going to get some funny orders from the boat's pilot. Obey them exactly as given. You won't have a second chance, so don't argue. Just do as you're told."
"Now just a minute," Horvath bellowed.
Rod cut him off. "Doctor, for reasons you will understand later, we are not going to explain a damned thing. Just do as you're told." He looked back to Sally. His eyes changed just a little. Perhaps there was concern in them. Something. A tiny spark of life came into them for a moment anyway. She tried to smile but failed.
"Please, Sally," he said. "Do exactly as Lennon's pilot instructs you.
All right? Out, now."
They stood immobile. Sally took a deep breath and turned toward the airlock.
"Let's go," she said.
She tried again to smile, but it only made her look more nervous. The starboard airlock had been reconnected to the embassy ship. They left by the port side. Lennon's boat crew had already rigged lines from the auxiliary vessel to the cutter. The boat was almost a twin for MacArthur's cutter, a flat-topped lifting body with a shovel-blade re-entry shield hanging below the nose. Sally pulled herself gently along the cable to Lennon's cutter, then cautiously moved through the hatch. She was halted when she entered the airlock. The mechanism cycled, and she felt pressure again. Her suit was a woven fabric that fitted like an extra skin. A baggy protective garment covered that. The only space inside her suit that she didn't fill was the helmet that joined the skin-tight body stocking with a neck seal.
"It will be necessary to search you, my lady," a guttural-voiced officer said.
She looked around. Two armed Marines stood in the airlock with her. Their weapons weren't aimed at her. Not quite. But they stood alertly, and they were afraid.
"What is this?" she demanded.
"All in good time, my lady," the officer said.
He assisted her in detaching the air bottle backpack from her suit. It was thrust into a transparent plastic container. The officer looked into her helmet after he took that off, then put it in with the backpack and her coveralls.
"Thank you," he muttered. "You will please now go aft. The others will join you there."
Renner and the other military personnel were treated differently.
"Strip," the officer said. "Everything, if you please."
The Marines did not even do them the courtesy of pointing their weapons slightly away. When they had removed everything, Renner even had to put his signet ring into the plastic container, they were sent forward.
Another Marine officer indicated battle armor, and two Marines helped them into it. There were no weapons in sight now.
"Damnedest striptease act I ever saw," Renner said to the pilot.
The coxswain nodded.
"Mind telling me what it's about?"
"Your captain will explain, sir," the coxswain said.
"More brownies," Renner exclaimed.
"Is that it, Mr. Renner?"
Whitbread asked from behind him.
The midshipman was climbing into battle armor as instructed. He hadn't dared ask anyone else, but Renner was easy to talk to.
Renner shrugged. There was an air of unreality about the situation. The cutter was packed with Marines and armor. Many were MacArthur's Marines. Gunner Kelly watched impassively from near the airlock, and he held his weapon trained at its door.
"That's all of them," a voice announced.
"Where is Chaplain Hardy?"
Renner asked.
"With the civilians, sir," the coxswain said.
"A minute, please."
He worked at the communications gear. The screen lit with Blaine's face.
"Secure circuit, sir," the coxswain announced.
"Thank you. Staley."
"Yes, Captain?"
the senior midshipman answered.
"Mr. Staley, this cutter will shortly come alongside Lennon. The civilians and cutter crew, except Coxswain Lafferty, will transfer to the battleship, where they will be inspected by security personnel. After they have left, you will take command of Lennon's number one cutter and proceed to MacArthur. You will board MacArthur from the starboard side immediately aft of the starboard petty officer's lounge. Your purpose is to create a diversion and engage any surviving enemies in that area in order to assist a group of civilians and Marines trapped in the lounge to escape. You will send Kelly and his Marines into that lounge with pressure suits and battle armor for 25 men. The equipment is already aboard. Send that party forward. Commander Cargill has secured the way forward of Bulkhead 160.
"Aye, aye, sir."
Staley sounded incredulous. He stood at near-rigid attention despite the absence of gravity in the cutter. Blaine almost smiled. At least there was a twitch to his lips.
"The enemy, mister, is several hundred miniature moties. They are armed with hand weapons. Some have gas masks. They are not well organized, but they are quite deadly. You will satisfy yourself that there are no other passengers or crew in the midship's starboard section of MacArthur. After that mission is accomplished, you will lead a party into the midship's crew mess and send out the coffee pot. But be damned sure that pot is empty, Mr. Staley."
"Coffee pot?"
Renner said incredulously.
Behind him, Whitbread shook his head and murmured something to Potter.
"Coffee pot, Mr. Renner. It has been altered by the aliens, and the technique used could be of great value to the Empire. You will see other strange objects, Mr. Staley. Use your judgment about bringing them out, but under no circumstances will you send out anything that might contain a live alien. And watch the crewmen. The miniatures have killed several people, used their heads as decoys, and inhabited their battle armor. Be sure that a man in armor is a man, Mr. Staley. We haven't seen them try that trick with a skin-tight pressure suit yet, but be damned careful."
"Yes, sir," Staley snapped.
"Can we regain control of the ship, sir?"
"No."
Blaine fought visibly for control of himself.
"You will not have long, mister. 40 minutes after you enter MacArthur, activate all conventional destruct systems, then start the timer on that torpedo we rigged. Report to me in the main port entryway when you've got it done. 55 minutes after you enter, Lennon will commence firing on MacArthur in any event. You have that?"
"Yes, sir,"
Horst Staley said quietly. He looked at the others. Potter and Whitbread looked back uncertainly.
"Captain?"
Renner said.
"Sir, I remind you that I'm senior officer here."
"I know that, Renner. I have a mission for you, too. You will take Chaplain Hardy back aboard MacArthur's cutter and assist him in recovering any equipment or notes that might be required. Another of Lennon's boats will come for that, and you will see that everything is packed into a sealed container the boat will bring."
"But, sir, I should be leading the boarding party."
"You're not a combat officer, Renner. Do you recall what you told me at lunch yesterday?"
Renner did.
"I did not tell you I was a coward," he grated. "I'm aware of that. I am also aware that you are probably the most unpredictable officer I have. The chaplain has been told only that there is a plague epidemic aboard MacArthur, and that we're going back to the Empire before it spreads to everybody.
That will be the official story to the Moties. They may not believe it, but Hardy'll have a better chance of selling it to them if he believes it himself. I have to have somebody who knows the real situation along, too. One of the midshipmen. Mr. Renner, get back aboard MacArthur's cutter. Staley, you have your orders.
Aye, aye, sir.
Renner departed, seething. 3 midshipmen and a dozen Marines hung from crash webbing in the main cabin of Lennon's cutter. The civilians and regular crew were gone, and the boat moved away from Lennon's black bulk. All right, Lafferty, Staley said. Take us to MacArthur's starboard side. If nothing attacks us, you will ram, aiming for the tankage complex aft of bulkhead 185.
Aye, aye, sir.
Lafferty did not react noticeably. He was a big-boned man, a plainsman from Tabletop. His hair was ash-blonde and very short, and his face was all planes and angles. The crash webbing was designed for high impacts. The midshipmen hung like flies in some monstrous spider web. Staley glanced at Whitbread. Whitbread looked at Potter. Both looked away from the Marines behind them. Okay. Go, Staley ordered. The drive roared. The real defensive hull of any warship is the Langston field. No material object could withstand the searing heat of fusion bombs and high-energy lasers, since anything that can get past the field and the ship's defensive fire will evaporate anything below, the hull of a warship is a relatively thin skin. It is, however, only relatively thin. A ship must be rigid enough to withstand high acceleration and jolt. Some compartments in tanks, however, are big, and in theory can be crushed by enough impact momentum. In practice, nobody had ever taken a combat party aboard a ship that way, as far as Staley's frantically searching memory could tell him. It was in the book, though. You could get aboard a crippled ship with her field intact by ramming. Staley wondered what damn fool had first tried it. The long black blob that enclosed MacArthur became a solid black wall without visible motion. Then the shovel blade re-entry shield went up. Horst watched blackness grow on the forward view screen as he peered over Lafferty's shoulder. The cutter surged backward. An instant of cold as they passed through the field, then the screaming of grinding metal. They stopped. Staley unclasped his crash webbing.
Get moving, he ordered.
Kelly, cut our way through those tanks.
Yes, sir.
The Marines swept past. 2 aimed a large cutting laser at the buckled metal that had once been the interior wall of a hydrogen tank. Cables stretched from the weapon back into the mangled cutter. The tank wall collapsed, a section blown outward and narrowly missing the Marines. More air whistled out, and dead miniature Moties blew about like autumn leaves. The corridor walls were gone. Where there had been a number of compartments, there was a heap of ruins, cut-off bulkheads, surrealistic machinery, and everywhere dead miniatures. None seemed to have had pressure suits.
Christ almighty, Staley muttered.
Okay, Kelly, get moving with those suits. Let's go! He charged forward across the ruins to the next airtight compartment door. Shows pressure on the other side, he said. He reached into the communications box on the bulkhead and plugged in his suit mic. Anybody there?
Corporal Hasner here, sir,
a voice answered promptly.
Be careful back there. That area is full of miniatures.
Not now, Staley answered. What's your status in there?
9 civilians without no suits in here, sir. 3 Marines left alive. We don't know how to get them scientist people out without suits.
We've got suits, Staley said grimly. Can you protect the civilians until we can get through this door? We're in vacuum.
Lord, yes, sir. Wait a minute.
Something whirred. Instruments showed the pressure falling beyond the bulkhead companionway. Then the dogs turned. The door opened to reveal an armored figure inside the petty officer's mess room. Behind Hasner, 2 other Marines trained weapons on Staley as he entered. Behind them, Staley gasped. The civilians were at the other end of the compartment. They wore the usual white coveralls of the scientific staff. Staley recognized Dr. Blevins, the veterinarian. The civilians were chattering among themselves.
But there's no air in here,
Staley yelled.
Not here, sir, Hasner said. He pointed. Some kind of box thing there. Makes like a curtain, Mr. Staley. Air can't get through it, but we can.
Kelly growled and moved his squad into the mess room. The suits were flung to the civilians. Staley shook his head in wonder.
Kelly, take charge here. Get everybody forward. And take that box with you, if it'll move.
It moves, Blevins said. He was speaking into the microphone of the helmet Kelly had passed him, but he wasn't wearing the helmet.
It can be turned on and off, too. Corporal Hasner killed some miniatures who were doing things to it.
Fine, we'll take it, Staley snapped. Get him moving, Kelly.
Sir.
The Marine gunner stepped gingerly through the invisible barrier. He had to push.
Like, maybe kind of like the field, Mr. Staley. Only not so thick.
Staley growled deep in his throat and motioned to the other midshipman.
Coffee pot, he said.
He sounded as if he didn't believe it.
Lafferty, Kruppman, Janowitz, you'll come with us.
He went back through the companionway to the ruins beyond. There was a double-door, airtight companionway at the other end, and Staley motioned Whitbread to open it. The dogs turned easily, and they crowded into the small airlock to peer through the thick glass into the main starboard connecting corridor.
"Looks normal enough," Whitbread whispered.
It seemed to be. They went through the airlock in two cycles and pulled themselves along the corridor walls by handholds to the entryway into the main crew mess room. Staley looked through the thick glass into the mess compartment.
"God's teeth!"
"What is it, Horst?" Whitbread asked. He crowded his helmet against Staley's. There were dozens of miniatures in the compartment. Most were armed with laser weapons, and they were firing at each other. There was no order to the battle. It seemed that every miniature was fighting every other, although that might have been only a first impression. The compartment drifted with a pinkish fog, Moti blood. Dead and wounded Motis flopped in an insane dance as the room winked with green-blue pencils of light.
"Not in there," Staley whispered.
He remembered he was speaking through his suit radio and raised his voice. "We'd never get through that alive. Forget the coffee pot." They moved on through the corridor and searched for other human survivors. There were none. Staley led them back toward the crew mess room.
"Kruppman," he barked. "Take Janowitz and get this corridor into vacuum. Burn out bulkheads, use grenades, anything, but get it into vacuum. Then get the hell off this ship."
"Aye, aye, sir."
When the Marines rounded a turn in the steel corridor, the midshipmen lost contact with them. The suit radios were line of sight only. They could still hear, though. MacArthur was alive with sound. High-pitched screams. The sounds of tearing metal, hums and buzzes. None of it was familiar.
"She's not ours anymore," Potter murmured.
There was a whoosh. The corridor was in vacuum. Staley tossed a thermite grenade against the messroom bulkhead and stepped back around a turn. Light flared briefly, and Staley charged back to fire his hand laser at the still-glowing spot on the bulkhead. The others fired with him. The wall began to bulge, then broke through. Air whistled into the corridor with a cloud of dead motis. Staley turned the dogs on the companionway, but nothing happened. Grimly, they burned at the bulkhead until the hole was large enough to crawl into. There was no sign of live miniatures.
"Why can't we do that all over the ship?" Whitbread demanded. "We could get back in control of her."
"Maybe," Staley answered. "Lafferty, get the coffee maker and take it portside. Move. We'll cover you." The plainsman waved and dove down the corridor in the direction the Marines had vanished.
"Had we nae best be going wi' him?" Potter asked.
"Torpedo," Staley barked. "We've got to detonate the torpedo."
"But Horst," Whitbread protested. "Can't we get control of the ship? I haven't seen any miniatures with vacuum suits."
"They can build those magic pressure curtains," Staley reminded him. "Besides, we've got our orders." He pointed aft, and they moved ahead of him. Now that MacArthur was clear of humans, they hurried, burning through airtight compartments and grenading the corridors beyond. Potter and Whitbread shuddered at the damage they were doing to the ship. Their weapons were not meant to be used aboard a working spacecraft. The torpedoes were in place. Staley and Whitbread had been part of the work crew that welded them on either side of the field generator. Only, the generator was gone. A hollow shell remained where it had been. Potter was reaching for the timers that would trigger the torpedo.
"Wait," Staley ordered.
He found a direct wire intercom outlet and plugged his suit in.
"Anyone? This is Midshipman Horst Staley in the field generator compartment. Anyone there?"
"Aye, aye, Mr. Staley," a voice answered.
"A moment, sir. Here's the captain."
Captain Blaine came on the line. Staley explained the situation. "The field generator's gone, sir, but the field seems strong as ever." There was a long pause. Then Blaine swore viciously, but cut himself off.
"You're over time, Mr. Staley. We've orders to close the holes in the field and get aboard Lennon's boats in 5 minutes. You'll never get out before Lennon opens fire."
"No, sir. What should we do?"
Blaine hesitated a moment.
"I'll have to buck that one up to the Admiral. Stay right where you are."
A sudden roaring hurricane sent them scurrying for cover. There was silence. Then Potter said unnecessarily,
"We're under pressure. Jan Brownies must have repaired one or another door."
"Then they'll soon be here,"
Whitbread cursed.
"Damn them anyway."
They waited.
"What's keeping the captain?"
Whitbread demanded. There was no possible answer, and they crouched tensely, their weapons drawn, while around them they heard MacArthur coming back to life. Her new masters were approaching.
"I won't leave without the middies," Rod was saying to the Admiral.
"You are certain they cannot reach after Port Airlock?"
Kutuzov said.
"Not in 10 minutes, Admiral. The Brownies have control of that part of the ship. The kids would have to fight all the way."
"Then what do you suggest?"
"Let them use the lifeboats, sir," Rod said, hopefully.
There were lifeboats in various parts of the ship, with a dozen, not 20 meters from the field generator compartment. Basically, solid fuel motors with inflatable cabins, they were meant only to enable a refugee to survive for a few hours in the event that the ship was damaged beyond repair, or about to explode. Either was a good description of MacArthur's present status.
"The miniatures may have built recording devices and transmitters into lifeboats," Kutuzov said. "A method of giving large motis all of MacArthur's secrets."
He spoke to someone else.
"Do you think that possible, Chaplain?"
Blaine heard Chaplain Hardy speaking in the background.
"No, sir, the miniatures are animals. I have always thought so. The adult motis say so, and all the evidence supports the hypothesis. They would be capable of that only if directly ordered, and, Admiral, if they've been that anxious to communicate with the motis, you can be certain they've already done it."
"Da,"
Kutuzov muttered.
"There is no point in sacrificing these officers for nothing. Captain Blaine, you will instruct them to use lifeboats, but caution them that no miniatures must come out with them. When they leave, you will immediately come aboard Lennon."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Rod sighed in relief and rang the intercom line to the generator compartment.
"Staley, the Admiral says you can use the lifeboats. Be careful there aren't any miniatures in them, and you'll be searched before you board one of Lennon's boats. Trigger the torpedoes and get away. Got that?"
"Aye, aye, sir."
Staley turned to the other middies.
"Lifeboats," he snapped.
"Let's—"
Green light winked around them.
"Visors down!"
Whitbread screamed. They dove behind the torpedoes while the beam swung wildly around the compartment. It slashed holes in the bulkheads, then through compartment walls beyond, finally through the hull itself. Air rushed out, and the beam stopped swinging, but it remained on, pouring energy through the hull into the field beyond. Staley swung his sun visor up. It was fogged with silver metal deposits. He ducked carefully under the beam to look at its source. It was a heavy hand laser. Half a dozen miniatures had been needed to carry it. Some of them, dead and dry, clung to the double handholds.
"Let's move," Staley ordered.
He inserted a key into the lock on the torpedo panel. Beside him, Potter did the same thing. They turned the keys and had 10 minutes to live. Staley rushed to the intercom.
"Mission accomplished, sir."
They moved through the airtight open compartment's door into the main after corridor and rushed sternward, flinging themselves from handhold to handhold. Null G races were a favorite, if slightly non-regulation game with midshipmen, and they were glad of the practice they'd had. Behind them, the timer would be clicking away.
"Should be here," Staley said.
He blasted through an airtight door, then fired a man-sized gap through the outer hull itself. Air whistled out. The miniatures had somehow again enclosed them in the stinking atmosphere of Moat Prime, even as they had come aft. Wisps of ice crystal fog hung in the vacuum. Potter found the lifeboat inflation controls and smashed the glass cover with his pistol butt. They stepped out of the way and waited for the lifeboats to inflate. Instead, the flooring swung up. Stored beneath the deck was a line of cones, each 2 meters across at the base, each about 8 meters long.
"The midnight brownie strikes again," said Whitbread.
The cones were all identical and fabricated from scratch. The miniatures must have worked for weeks beneath the deck, tearing up the lifeboats and other equipment to replace them with these things. Each cone had a contoured crash chair in the big end and a flared rocket nozzle in the point.
"Look at the damn things, Potter," Staley ordered. "See if there's anywhere brownies could hide in them."
There didn't seem to be. Except for the conical hull, which was solid, everything was open framework. Potter tapped and pried, while his friends stood guard. He was looking for an opening in the cone when he caught a flicker of motion in the corner of his eye. He snatched a grenade from his belt and turned. A spacesuit floated, out of the corridor wall. It held a heavy laser in both hands. Staley's nerves showed in his voice.
"You! Identify yourself!"
The figure raised its weapon. Potter threw the grenade. Intense green light lashed out through the explosion, lighting the corridor weirdly and tearing up one of the conical lifeboats.
"Was it a man?" Potter cried. "Was it? The arms bent wrong. Its legs stuck straight out. What was it?"
"An enemy," Staley said. "I think we'd better get out of here. Board the boats while we've still got 'em."
He climbed into the reclined contour seat of one of the undamaged cones. After a moment, the others each selected a seat. Horst found a control panel on a bar and swung it out in front of him. There were no labels anywhere. Sentient or non-sentient, all Motis seemed to be expected to solve the workings of a machine at a glance.
"I'm going to try the big square button," Staley said firmly. His voice sounded oddly hollow through the suit radio. Grimly, he pushed the button.
A section of the hull blew away beneath him. The cone swung out as on a sling. Rockets flared briefly. Cold and blackness, and he was outside the field. Two other cones popped out of the black sea. Frantically, Horst directed his suit radio toward the looming black hulk of Lenin no more than a kilometer away.
"Midshipman Staley here. The lifeboats have been altered. There are three of us, and we're alone aboard them."
A fourth cone popped from the blackness. Staley turned in his seat. It looked like a man. Three hand weapons fired simultaneously. The fourth cone glowed and melted, but they fired for a long time. "One of the... Staley didn't know what to report. His circuit might not be secure.
"We have you on the screens, midshipman," a heavily accented voice said. "Move away from MacArthur and wait for pickup. Did you complete your mission?"
"Yes, sir." Staley glanced at his watch. 4 minutes to go, sir."
"Then move fast, mister," the voice ordered.
But how? Staley wondered.
The controls had no obvious function. While he searched frantically, his rocket fired. But what? He hadn't touched anything.
"My rocket's firing again," said Whitbread's voice. He sounded calm, much calmer than Staley felt.
"Aye, and mine," Potter added. "Never look a gift horse in the mouth. We're moving away from yon ship."
The rumble continued. They were accelerating together at nearly a standard G, with Moat Prime a vast green crescent to one side. On the other was the deep black of the coal sack, and the blacker mass of Lenin. The boats accelerated for a long time.